You're listening to a 95BFM podcast. Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Andrew Little joined me again this week, bright and early, for our regular chat where we discuss the Ngāti Rangi settlement and how sexual violence is treated in the criminal justice system. Here is Andrew.
First of all, the deed of settlement has been signed between Ngāti Rangi and the Crown. How are you feeling about this?
Yeah, no, it's good, actually. Look, most of the work was actually done by my predecessor, Chris Finneson, but it's good to sort of draw it together and be part of the celebration of the final signing of the deed. They had a great day on Saturday at the Rākete Pō Marae, just south of Waiuru. And look, it was a beautiful day and it was a good day, a great celebration.
And so what sort of things happened? Was there a formal apology from the Crown?
One of the things I get to do as Minister is to deliver the formal apology, and that's always it's amazing. You do the rest of the speech and you get the apology, and actually the place just goes absolutely dead quiet, and you realise the significance of what it is that you're doing as Minister on behalf of the Crown, acknowledging the, when I say treaty breaches, that sounds very kind of saccharine, but it's, the hurt that those people and their ancestors have felt and have carried through the generations. You really sense that when you deliver that apology. So it's amazing to be part of that.
And there often tends to be a focus on the financial redress, which in this case was $17 million. But how important was the cultural redress to Ngāti Rangi?
Oh, really important, because they, like a lot of iwi, particularly in that area, they lost a lot of land. There was one of the land grabs was the Waimarino block, and it was just taken as a punishment. Including for iwi who were actually loyal to the Crown at the time, including Ngāti Rangi. Ngāti Rangi was one of the loyalist iwi, loyalist tribes to the Crown. So they feel hugely hurt by the loss of that land. A lot of that land now is tied up in the National Park, some of it's Defence Force land. So one of the things they did was there was an acknowledgement that a chunk of land would be returned to that iwi. They would gift it back to the Defence Force for their use, but they acknowledged as having an ownership to take in it in a way that hadn't been acknowledged before. And that stuff is important. Sri Lanka iwi, and I'm just having this discussion with iwi on the East Coast at the moment, you know, what you realise is what's important to them is their identity. A lot of the names of these iwi have been lost and buried because they've got nothing. They've got their people, but they've got nothing else to show for it. And what they're looking for are landmarks that assert their sense of identity and who they are and the fact that they have a place, you know, in the area in which their people used to live.
And you touched on this before, but Ngāti Rangi is one of the iwi in collective negotiations over Tongariro National Park. Do you think this settlement will have any bearing on these negotiations?
Yeah, there's things that that don't get sorted out in their individual settlement, so the one that we signed on Saturday, that get transferred over into what are called the collective negotiations. So there's four or five iwi tied up in the Tongariro National Park negotiations. Tōwharatoa is probably the biggest. And then there's a few others dotted around the mountain. So that will be important because there's a contest about the gifting of the mountain from Tōwharatoa originally to the governor, to the Crown, so that'll be a subject of negotiation, and then how the various stakes that each of those iwi have in the mountain and in the national park are actually reflected. So that's going to be very important. That mountain, the Maunga, Rōpeho, and Tongariro and Ngāti Rangi are very important to those iwi. They're important spiritual landmarks for them, so it's going to be an interesting set of negotiations.
And moving on to the New Zealand Crime and Victims Survey, so this will take place every year and you're replacing the less regular New Zealand Crime and Safety Survey with this. Why are you doing this?
I think it's just to reflect, get a more meaningful set of results about, you know, people's experience of crime and, you know, to the extent to which they are a victim of crime. They've been doing the survey in the past. And the advice we've had is that we can do it better and get more meaningful information out of it. We need to know, we can find out from the police who they're arresting, how many they're arresting and what charges and all the rest of it. What we're not good at getting is the experience at the other end, the victim end, you know, whether it's a burglary, whether it's something more serious, and the experience then also of how the system has handled the crime that was committed against them.
And what will this year's survey focus on?
I'm not quite sure whether there's any specific focus this year. I think there's a new, trying to get the victim questions right is essential. So there's a bit of experimentation this year in that. But I think we're just trying to make sure that the information we do collect, the data we get, is something that is useful to inform policy decisions.
So is the information used to inform policy, or what else is done with it?
Yeah, it gets us an understanding of the amount or the volume of crime, but also who are being affected. You know, we already have an instinct that, most victims of crime have a pretty obvious profile, and that tends to be people in lower socioeconomic areas. And this idea that a lot of rich and wealthy people are victims of crime actually isn't borne out by the statistics. Actually, people living in poorer areas are more likely to be victims of crime than those in more well-off areas. So we know that already. It's about making sure that what we do with that information is going to make a difference.
And last week, the Together in Black campaign took place, highlighting the difficulties victims of sexual violence face in the criminal justice system. Do you feel the criminal justice system is letting victims of sexual violence down?
Yeah, I think that's been known for a while, and we've got to do better. The Law Commission started some work some years ago, and the previous government basically stopped it in its tracks. I know that I and my colleagues, people like Jan Logie, who's the Under-Secretary for Justice, with a specific focus on family and domestic violence, we are keen to get that work resumed, because we need to make sure that the experience of victims of sexual violence going through the criminal justice system is one that doesn't re-victimise them. Because that is the experience of a lot of people who go through that, and we need to make sure that whether it's conduct of trials, whether it's police interviews, whether it's whatever, and acknowledging that improvements have been made in some of those areas already, but we need to make sure it's a system that doesn't put victims of sexual violence off recording what's happened to them and trying to seek justice.
Because the adversarial system sort of puts the victim on trial as much as it does the defendant. Could you see possibly judge-led questioning in the future?
Look, those are options that have been raised in the past. I think they're all stuff that needs to be explored. There is our style of system, called adversarial. I mean, it is about testing evidence. We still accept in our system that the Crown bears the onus of proof. If the state is going to accuse somebody of a crime that could lead to them being deprived of their liberty, then it is right that the state should be put to proof to a reasonably high degree. So I think that is right. We've got to make sure that those who are victims of sexual violence aren't re-victimised in the process. And I'm confident there are ways that that can be handled that protect protect victims of those sorts of crimes, in terms of being, not having to front up and be in the same room as the perpetrator of the crime against them, but being available to answer questions about what has happened to them.
And will you possibly be introducing other support for perpetrators to ensure they don't reoffend and really recognise the severity of their crime, rather than just, say, putting them in prison and not really reforming them as such?
Yeah, it's interesting, some of the feedback you get from some of the NGOs in the sector, and particularly organisations like Women's Refuge, saying actually there are a lot of women who say that they want the perpetrator of the crime against them called to account, because in most cases they actually know that they know the person, but they actually want them to get some sort of help. They don't necessarily want them locked up in prison. They want them to get the help they need to deal with anger or violence or the kind of power issues that actually lie at the heart of a lot of sexual violence. So we are keen to see there is a more effective response to sexual violence offenders to fix whatever problem it is that they've got that's causing their offending, in addition to being called to account for what they've done.
Because it is estimated that up to 80% of cases go unreported. Does this sort of show the system is broken? Is this going to be a priority for you?
Yeah, in fact, I thought the figure was higher. I thought it was as high as 90%, actually. Because for a lot of victims, they just don't... They see a system that is hostile to them, and so they just don't report it, and they have to deal with it in their own sort of ways, and often not dealing with it at all, and that leads to other catastrophes later in life. We do have to find a better way of dealing with crimes of sexual violence so that, they are being reported and the people who need help get that help, both victims and defenders.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.